Inre Sigi, BAP 25-1058, Ofer Raviv, appearing for appellant, Mark Murakami, appearing for appellee.
Good morning, members of the panel. Thank you for coming out here. I think I'm almost single-handedly responsible for you coming out here. You're welcome. The main thing I want to touch with is really on the issue of the application of Bunter.
Did you want to reserve time for rebuttal? I forgot to ask you.
3 minutes, please.
3 minutes. All right. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I hope I'm not going to butcher the name. It's hard for me with the name, but the Supreme Court case of Barton Werfer and the application in this case, so 523A4. And I had to think about it because I understand why it was applied, but I think to begin with the Supreme Court in that case, when I was a bit on a limb, but that was their decision and they decided to apply in this case an undischargeability action to an actor who wasn't really part of, quote, the fraud. And I think the main, and I'm sure I'm sure the panel's members, you read this, and my guess is you probably already have a pretty strong opinion one way or another at this point. But the main key, really, what I wanted to key on this is where the difference between those two is, to me, it's, in many ways, it's the mens rea, really, when it comes to non-dischargeability issues.
But that was the whole point in Barton Werfer, is that the mens rea didn't really determine it. That was the prior. Barton Werfer held that it's the debt. It's a debt for fraud, or in this case, a debt for defalcation of fiduciary. There is no mens rea, isn't there?
I'm going to get to that. I will get to that. There's a point I'm trying to make with that. What I'm saying is, if you look at it, to me, it's akin to in a criminal code when you have the different elements that you need to prove. And the thing is, under A2, in that case, the debtor met all the elements except for, quote, the mens rea thing. In A4, one of the elements, you have to be acting in a fiduciary capacity. That is before we even get to the culpability question. And that is a big difference between the thing, because there's also an element of assumption of risk. In this case, under Barton Werfer, we had business partners. There's an assumption of risk. You go into business with someone, you're thinking something can happen. But let's look at this case. In this particular case, we have a passive actor who really has nothing to do with it. If you want to take, in this case, you say there was an unjust enrichment. Okay, and I will give an extreme example. Just to illustrate.
Before you get there, you can clear up something for me that was the appeal, and your argument is focusing on Barton Werfer and the application of that to A4. I assume we're going to get to, you know, the construction of the unjust enrichment debt. There's really no argument as to the liability for unjust enrichment, though, is there?
Well, I mean, let's put it this way. There's not a strong argument. Yeah, I will concede that. There's not a strong argument because ultimately he received the benefit in this case, and that's all it took. Well, I would say this, that the only reason that the bankruptcy court will even issue a judgment to begin with when there's an undischargeability action is if the court first determines an undischargeability. In other words, If the panel agrees to set aside an undischargeability issue, the whole judgment needs to be set aside and it needs to go back for the court to determine the whole thing. It's not just that. The court will not issue a judgment in this case, because this was part of a Chapter 13 case. There was no reason to file a judgment. This was part of the plan, which is going to be the issue of the next appeal that I'm going to be discussing. But the non-dischargeability is a key, not only for this case. I think it's a pretty extraordinary decision. And quite frankly, I think only the Supreme Court can probably answer this question at the end of the day, because that was their opinion. And they will have to decide whether they want to extend it even further to this. And again, there's a reason I want to make this argument. This to Mr. Sigi. Let's just take an extreme example. He was in a coma the whole time because he was not an actor in any of this thing. Wakes up after 10 years and he discovers that while he was not around with us, not active in any way, this whole thing happened. In the meantime, the property is gone, and all of a sudden, someone is suing him for this debt. Is that the outcome we want? That someone who really
it
never
depends,
assumed it,
doesn't
never asked
it?
For it?
Because you're shading over the key point in Barton Werfer, which is the fundamental liability, as you alluded to, of partners for joint debts. If you have an agent, if you have a conspiracy, if you have an alter ego, if that person is liable for the fraud,
But none of those things
it were. It doesn't matter that they did not have the mens rea to conduct the fraud. Right. It's because they're liable.
I agree.
Why is that construct not applied to A4, especially in light of our decision in Del Rosario?
Because there is absolutely nothing in this case to suggest that Mr. Seeger was an agent, an alter ego, any of those things.
But that then calls into the question of the liability for unjust enrichment.
Correct. But right? Then
it isn't a Martin Werfer at that time. It's his individual liability.
But in this case, but I think the panel can agree with me, if you break down the elements, the debtor under A2 met all the elements, meaning that there was a debt that was incurred that was part of that the partnership and all the and everything that flows from that. 524, you need to overcome the issue that while acting in a fiduciary capacity, you have to be either the fiduciary or someone that was partners with him. There was no proof in this case, especially on some of the judgment.
In our decision in Del Rosario, we interpreted A6, and there we distinguished Barton Werfer because A6 says a debt for willful and malicious done by the debtor.
Right.
That language isn't in A4.
It is not. Correct. But it is, but while acting in a fiduciary capacity, is part of the element that comes
before. Person who is liable for whose liability then gets transferred to another, that would seem to be the requirement under Barton Werfer, wouldn't it?
No. We can disagree, but my position is you have to first, in order to fit into this exception, you have to be in your fiduciary capacity, or if you want to extend it, you need to have something. And in this particular case, even if we accept the argument that an agent, alter ego of this of the fiduciary can be held, in this particular case, this was a motion for summary judgment. The court couldn't even make those findings under a summary judgment. In this case, this had to go to trial to even determine whether Mr. Seege had any capacity, any involvement. And again, I'm giving the example. Let's say he was truly not around this whole time, was not around, and this benefit was conferred upon him.
How is that different if it's a Barton Werfer situation under 523A2 and the gentleman's a partner who happens to be in coma? He wakes up, he's still a partner, he's still liable.
Right. The two differences is, number one, the elements on the A2 is that you meet pretty much all the elements. Okay, this is for money. You meet all the elements of the section in a sense that you were the person who the debt was incurred for your purpose. Okay, and everything that's all the other elements there. The only differences in that case is, again, that's why I said at the beginning, the mens rea section. And that it boils down to, and that's how you can extend it. But there is, in A4, you need to be a fiduciary. That's my position, that you have to be someone in a fiduciary capacity in order to do
this. Clearly, Marilyn was the fiduciary, right?
Right.
Marilyn was the second, right?
That, there's no one questions that. She was. She was. The question is, did Stephen act with her? Did he assist her? In what way? And that hasn't even been proven. So I think at a threshold matter, the minimum, even if you want to consider that, you need to have a finding that Mr. Seege, in this case, had acted in any active way to be a part of this.
I mean, Judge Ferris did find that they were, based upon his ruling for unjust enrichment, that it was a joint debt, though. Didn't he basically say that Stephen Seege's liability was for the liability of Marilyn Seege?
Yep.
As to the discrete items that he picked that he got the benefit for.
Right. But based on unjust enrichment, then let's look at the elements of unjust enrichment. Unjust enrichment does not require any form of participation.
But that's a different argument than Barton Werfer.
Correct. Yeah. It is. But I think it's an important distinction. I do think the Supreme Court is the one who ultimately is going to really, the only one who can really answer fully this answer, because I don't want to like use the wrong term, say it's a legal fiction, but they went ahead and extended it. It was, to me, a pretty extraordinary decision. And I believe they were probably wanted to be very narrowly construed and not all of a sudden now open a floodgate and now we're trying to fit
just everything. Like Stern. So can I ask a slightly different question? Okay. Is there anything in 523A4 in the text that you can hang your argument on that what matters is the debtor's fiduciary position, that the debtor has to be in a fiduciary position rather than, you know, in this case, Mrs. Seege. Like, is there something in the text that leads you to conclude that that this statute is different than A2? Any words you can point us to?
To me, the key is, like I said, I'm going to repeat that, is specifically the issue of the fiduciary capacity.
So you're saying the debtor has to be the one acting in the fiduciary capacity?
Correct.
But does it say that in the statute?
That is how I read it, and I think that is where the distinction is. In under A2, it doesn't say what the debtor needs to be. It just says, in this case, you were like, if you're a partner, you automatically fit into that thing. The only question now becomes whether you have the mens rea for that. But in A4, there is the element, we're actually identifying a very specific function within there. And in order to, it's the same thing. In that case, it was a debtor and it was someone else. But that someone else was an agent, the fact that they were partners, business partners. But here in under A4, if we are going to extend the fiduciary capacity outside of that, my argument is, at a minimum, if we even want to do this, we need to show that in this particular case, Mr. Seege had an additional role in his somewhere, like an agent. Of course, if there was some kind of collusion, conspiracy, then yeah, I mean, at that point, it's hard to say that he wasn't a part of it. But in this case, none of those things were found. And again, the unjust enrichment, to begin with, does not require any of those elements. You're just going to sit here. Someone can write you a big check, and you just got all this money landing in your checking account. Okay, great. You don't even know about it, for example. And now you have nothing to do with this, and you have the money in your hands. And the question is, and later on you lost the money for whatever reason, now you are held responsible for it, and it's non-dischargeable when you really truly had nothing to do with it. You didn't assume a risk. That's how it is. I mean, I also run a business. I know that there's an element of risk when you run a business, when you go into partnerships with anyone. That is part of the thing that you probably take into consideration.
So you're saying unjust enrichment cannot be the basis for this judgment because he was basically, it's a passive claim?
Correct.
But don't the elements require that the benefit, the retention of the benefit, had been unjust? And didn't the bankruptcy court rely on the circumstances surrounding his wife's conduct to conclude that his retention of those benefits under this circumstance were unjust?
That's not how I read it. No, that's not how I read it.
So what's your understanding of why the bankruptcy court decided that his retention of those benefits would be unjust in these circumstances?
The elements of unjust, I don't have it in front of me, but the element of unjust enrichment, all it requires is essentially that there was no consideration. You received the benefit, you didn't do anything for it. And that's the lowest hanging fruit, in a sense. Every time when you try to prove damages, right, you try to culpability, whatever it is, the easiest thing to show is just unjust enrichment, meaning that you would just receive the benefit at a minimum. And that's the lowest bar that you have.
So if we agree with you, it should be sent back to the bankruptcy court to decide if there's any other basis for non-dischargeability other than unjust enrichment?
Correct.
All right. You're inside 2 minutes.
Okay. I will take my 2 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I think one thing that's been lost in this first appeal is that Barton Werfer kind of dictates, and this panel's decision in Del Rosario dictates, there are two separate inquiries when faced with a discharge under 523. The first is the underlying state law claim. And Hawaii state law of unjust enrichment provides in basic that when plaintiff confers a benefit upon defendant and it's unjust for the defendant to retain that benefit, a good claim in unjust enrichment shall lie, which is our situation here, where there is no factual dispute. This is before the court on Rule 56, and Judge Ferris noted that there was no separate evidence, separate concise statement of facts. no factual dispute presented to the court to oppose the motion for summary judgment on unjust enrichment grounds. To be sure, our adversary proceeding sought various claims for relief, conversion, larceny, embezzlement, whatever. And Judge Ferris kind of honed in and he said, what claim are you seeking summary judgment for today? And I said, unjust enrichment, as a matter of Hawaii state law. Now, he found there were no issues of fact and that Stephen was unjustly enriched in four separate categories. Settlement of a lawsuit against him individually, construction on his house that was in his own name, purchase of a car in his own name, and $42,000 after Mrs. Felipe died. He didn't just blanket move the judgment we had against Marilyn over onto Stephen. He went through and figured out exactly the way Stephen was unjustly enriched and awarded summary judgment along those lines. Then we turn to how the bankruptcy code should treat that situation. And while we would all be blessed, and Your Honors especially, if Congress included some commas and parentheses, the core lesson of Bartenwerfer is that 523, you don't get to the 523A numbers past the word debt. And so the word debt is modified by all that list. And then the court noted in Bartenwerfer, as a matter of statutory interpretation, the words by the debtor are not used in every single exception. Some are, some aren't. 523A4, which is before the court today, doesn't include that. And so using this passive voice, the lesson from Bartenwerfer is that so long as the debt was carried out and constituted defalcation, that discharge exception doesn't apply.
But can I ask you, was it Bartenwerfer a case where state law provided that the debtor was vicariously liable? And isn't that different than this case?
Yes and no. And so let me kind of, I do think that Bartenwerfer below, and I do think that that case came from this panel, involved underlying principles that predated, you know, the first version of the Bankruptcy Code in the 1800s. I don't think, however, the Supreme Court went through that analytical lens. They went through statutory construction and hunted the words by the debtor, by the debtor, by the debtor through each of them. And I think the core ruling in Bartenwerfer was that because the provision didn't have by the debtor in there, it didn't matter who the one conveying it. And so I do think some of the lower bankruptcy courts post-Bartenwerfer have grappled with this and tried to harmonize the strand in the earlier cases with Bartenwerfer, but I don't think, and we went through this exercise with Judge Ferris, I don't think that the Supreme Court ruling can be read that way. That the absence of the words by the debtor means that so long as your debt arises from, you know, a defalcation acting by someone in a fiduciary capacity, which there's no issue of fact that that took place, then the discharge is unable, you're not able to get discharge under 523A4.
So long as the original debt's a debt that is not dischargeable in this instance for fraud or defalcation while acting in a fiduciary capacity.
Correct.
Your argument must be that the unjust enrichment was a debt for fraud or defalcation while acting in a fiduciary capacity, right?
Thank you. And I forgot the second part of your question. So we're not saying that all unjust enrichment judgments fall under the 523A4. This unjust enrichment claim, which does have the factual connection to defalcation, does apply. And so it's, but where does this debt arise from?
You just deviated. You jumped from Stephen being unjustly enriched. And again, no disrespect for not using last names, but Stephen was unjustly enriched, but Marilyn was the one that committed the fiduciary bad acts. They don't merge, do they?
There's a separate inquiry. So our state law claim against unjust enrichment stands on itself. If I rob a bank, $1 million, and give it to you, the bank is entitled to come after you for restitution to give it back.
It doesn't matter how you got it.
Correct.
And that's the problem here is the fact that his wife did bad acts and harmed the trust wasn't a factor in the unjust. It was just enriched that Stephen got the benefit of that, and therefore he was liable. That's independent of fiduciary defalcation.
It for sure, the state law claim is entirely independent of the the benefactor of the unjust enrichment, right? So if Stephen got all these benefits to his house and his property and his car and cash, it doesn't matter who gave it to him. However, when we go through the lens of 523A4, it's the character of the debt. And to be sure, we have a judgment that was affirmed by this panel 2 years ago against Maryland for several of these things, the house construction, the car, the fraud lawsuit settlement. And so it's the characterization of the debt that matters. That's the lesson of a Bartenwerfer. And
the characterization of the debt here, isn't it? It's unjust enrichment.
The claim and the judgment against him for sure is unjust enrichment. And so then the question
is, why isn't that the end of the story?
Because when we go for a discharge, it's the characterization of the debt. Where did that debt come from?
The debt came because he got something that he shouldn't have had.
Right.
But that's it. That's all
we need. In concert with someone, a trustee that defalcated to get there.
But that's not required for unjust enrichment.
It isn't required, for sure. That's a separate inquiry. And it's only, we only have this conversation in the discharge context. And so the issue is, under Bartenwerfer, whether this debt, which there's no factual question where that money came from. It came from a trustee that stole it.
Let me ask a different question. Let's say Marilyn, instead of buying a car for Stephen, she bought a car for a neighbor in the neighborhood who was down on their luck, whatever. She bought them a car. So, and then that neighbor ultimately files bankruptcy. Do we get in it and they're unjustly enriched by the receipt of the car because it came from the trust funds? Do you get an unjust enrichment, a non-dischargeability judgment against that neighbor, the third party, unrelated third party down the street? Do you get a judgment against them for a non-dischargeability because Marilyn was found liable for breaching her fiduciary duty?
It's for sure, that for sure is a closer call. However, the code uses the word debt and not the actor. And so I think that's a lesson for Bartenwerfer.
Yeah, but the question is, how far does that go, right? Does it go to the neighbor? Does it go to the random person? You know, Bartenwerfer, as Judge Barish pointed out, was a situation where Mr. and Mrs. Bartenwerfer were, before they were married, in a partnership, a real estate partnership. And California real estate law says that partners are liable for the fraud of another. Where in Hawaii law is there an equivalent that says if you're unjustly enriched, you know, because of somebody's defalcation, you're liable for their defalcation? I'm trying to figure out how do we get from unjust enrichment to defalcation while acting in a fiduciary capacity?
It's the conveyance by which the unjust enrichment took place. And no factual issue where the money came from. And unlike the situation of your neighbor with, you know, that just happens to get the bag of cash or whatever, Stephen was partner in front row seats every step of the way. He had an individual fraud lawsuit pending against him individually that these funds were used to settle. He has a car today that was used for these funds. He had an improvement to his house, which he owns today, used for trust funds. And so for him to come into bankruptcy court under Chapter 13 with, you know, we're the only unsecured debt against them. Mm-hmm. That's not what this code is for. It's not supposed to protect people that receive these ill-gotten gains. And so when Maryland first filed bankruptcy, we're into this conversation about if a bank robber steals money and gives it to you, should the bankruptcy court protect either of them? Should the code protect either of them? And I don't think it should, because it would interfere with the ability of the only injured party here was the trust to get recovery. He still sits here today with assets that were purloined from the trust.
Did his participation or non-participation matter?
Factually, I think he participated. He still is maintaining the benefit.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Finish.
The code doesn't draw many of those distinctions, unfortunately, for those trying to apply it. And I get that.
So I was thinking of I was going to take your hypothetical and turn it up just a little more, which is someone robs a bank, okay, and in the haste of trying to get away, drops a bag of cash. And someone comes along and finds the bag of cash. That person may be liable for unjust enrichment. They found a bag of cash. It wasn't theirs. They had nothing to do with the bank robbery. Right. They don't even, although maybe they should have suspected, they didn't have it. They had no, even no knowledge. Okay. Would that, would a judgment for unjust enrichment against them be non-dischargeable? It traces back to a bad act, right? The bank robbery, but they had no knowledge, no participation. Does your answer change?
No. Because it's the debt. And 523 starts with the word debt. And I think that's what Barton-Werfer said. And they glossed over debtor. And then the last word before the list of discharge exemptions is debt. And so where did that debt come from? And so in our bank robber scenario, that debt plainly came from illegal act. And so while state law governs the restitution, disgorgement of the proceeds of that, this court shouldn't give haven or prevent the creditor from getting recovery against them.
So basically, you're advocating that Barton-Werfer requires a tracing or allows a tracing.
Yes, Your Honor. That so long as we prove that there was a debt that arises from defalcation, in this case, and we are trying to. This is unjust enrichment. It's an equitable claim. Judge Ferris found that it would be equitable. It would be unjust for Stephen to retain house improvements, lawsuit settlement, and I hit this the last time too, and I apologize, the car and the cash. And so when we grapple with how fair it is and what the limiting principle is for Barton-Werfer and how far it should go to non-actors or innocent third parties, factually, we don't have that here because all the claim that Judge Ferris did approve were for current benefits, traceable directly, trust funds, no factual issues anymore, and that he still retains to this day.
Do you have a case that takes Barton-Werfer to the tracing resulting from analysis that you're advocating?
Your Honor, the post-Barton-Werfer cases tend to be separating out state law claim and defalcation and I'm not sure why we're the first ones to actively litigate defalcation now twice, but perhaps counsel is smarter than I am in taking these cases. But so no. However, I do think that the lesson, when we look at what the Supreme Court did in light of the 150 years or 40 years of history in how partnership liabilities get imputed to non-acting partners, and the Supreme Court chucked all that and went strictly with the textual analysis. And so when we look at 523, the words debt are after the debtor. And so the list of exemptions, you know, apply all to the debt. Factually, we have traced this and proven it after a contested trial where we proved and satisfied Bullock and proved up the mens rea against Maryland. And so there is no factual question as to the character of the debt, and that debt definitely arose factually and legally from trustee defalcation.
I want to end, asking the same question Judge Brand asked your opposing counsel. If we disagree with you and find that this, if we could construe Barton-Werfer narrowly and find that this is not a non-dischargeable debt, my understanding is that you waived all the other claims to make this final. What would happen in that situation?
We would have a money judgment against him for unjust enrichment that was dischargeable. Now,
so you would think we would just reverse. There would be no need to remand.
The dischargeability, I don't think will turn on facts. I mean, to the extent if you found there were disputed facts, I don't know how we could. But if there was a factual, this panel thought that summary judgment was inappropriate, and we had to have a trial on the facts.
Right.
Okay, then that's. I think it would be vacate and remand for a trial. But
your other causes of action are gone.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. So just a couple of things, Your Honors. Number one, I think that the correct reading has to stop end with the fiduciary capacity. That's my position. But even if the court is willing to extend the fiduciary capacity to an agent or something along those lines, I think the example that Your Honor asked Mr. Murakami about the neighbor and so forth, at a minimum, if we are going to take this extraordinary step and extend it, the court needs to make an affirmative finding. And in this particular case, the debtor, Mr. Sigi, at a minimum, meets that criteria as an agent, the alter ego. One of those things has to be found at a minimum, because none of it was found in this case. It was just not there. So at a minimum, that has to happen, especially when we're looking at a pretty extraordinary step, when we are expanding, taking a really broad view of the statute. I was never there to begin with.
Any questions? Thank you. Thank you both for your argument.
Thank you very much.
Let's call the next case. I want to give them a second to catch their breath.
I'll very slowly.